There's a chap coming to town tomorrow to speak about what really goes on at Nauru. This is the images you see on the news. A lot of journalists can't get anywhere closer than what a telephoto lens will give them. Well, he's been there, and his latest book is looking at the aftermath of the riots there, and it's called Nauru Burning. His name's Mark Isaacs. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rick. How are you going?
Very well, thanks. How did you come to spend time on Nauru?
Oh, it was way back in 2012. A friend of mine sent me a message saying, hey, the Salvation Army are hiring people to go to Nauru. They've got an ad on Facebook. You should have a look at it, believe it or not. And so I was given a number, and I called it and said I'd like to go to Nauru, and they said, sure, when can you leave? And then about a week later, I was in Nauru.
How much training did you get to deal with such a difficult and different environment?
Yeah, funnily enough, I had no training, and if they'd checked my resume properly, they would have seen that I was completely had no experience working with refugees, had no kind of university qualifications, and my situation was not uncommon for those early days. We were there a week after the camp was first opened, and the majority of people I worked with were in a similar kind of situation to me.
And were the Salvation Army there as observers, or were they there actually being paid by the government as service providers?
No, the Salvation Army had quite a lucrative contract. I think most service providers in these offshore detention centres get paid huge amounts of money to provide services there. And the Salvation Army, way back in 2012, were supposed to be the lead agency who was supposed to run the detention centre and provide the welfare services for the people who were detained there.
So they're potentially making a buck out of it. Did you do police checks or working with vulnerable people checks?
Yeah, we did police checks, but I mean, it was within a week, so I can't fully remember just how much of those we did and what the process was. But, you know, a week later we were there, and I think the best training we got was on how to not speak to a journalist, because we were told that everything you see and hear and do in Nauru is confidential, so you cannot talk to anyone about anything that happens there for all time. Those are the contracts we were supposed to sign. And, you know, we were working with vulnerable people, and we weren't explained who they were, what the cultural differences were, why they were there, how we could help them, what would happen if they hurt themselves or tried to commit suicide, which we came across while we were there. And, you know, we had 18-year-olds there. I was 1 year out of uni. Some of the kids there were working at McDonald's before they went to Nauru.
In this particular book, you're looking at one big event, a riot and a fire that destroyed a lot of the regional processing centre in July. Why did you want to focus on that particular event?
So I left the island about a month before that event, and when it happened, I was, you know, the workers that my colleagues and the workers that I worked with were extremely upset about the way it was reported on in the media. It was, you know, deemed as this rebellion where all the people inside the detention centre were blamed for the actions of a small few. And I wanted to understand why it happened, what happened in the aftermath of the event, and how the people who were treated, whether they were guilty or innocent. This fire was an example for me of the way frustrations boil over in these detention centres. We've seen riots happen numerous times before across different groups of people across a decade of detention centres. At some point, we have to start asking, is it the people inside the detention centres who are responsible for these things, or is it the system and the way they're treated that causes people to react in such a way? Many of my colleagues said, you have to investigate this. You have to look at what happened to people once the fire happened. How was the fire investigated? How were people imprisoned? And how were they deemed guilty or not guilty? And so that was essentially what the book was about. And in doing the investigation, I started to see the unfettered power that service providers have to do whatever they want over there. The investigation into who was responsible for the fire was run by the Wilson Security Organisation, not by the Nauruan police. And the way that it was investigated, the way evidence was collected, was extremely dubious. There are accusations that the evidence was collected unfairly and unjustly. And if you think that it wasn't done by the Nairn Police and by a private security company, why is this happening? Why is a private security company investigating this when you've got a perfectly good police department that can do it?
How did you get information about what happened afterwards? Because you weren't working there anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So I started collecting information about a year after the event, and by that time, a large majority of the people who were there at the time were now back in Australia. And that included the men detained inside the detention centre. That included staff from service providers like the Salvation Army, security companies, the Department of Immigration, health services, and a wide number of people outside of those service providers who were also involved. And I got these first-hand accounts, pulled them together, but the difficulty with doing that is that everyone I spoke to was scared, whether it be Australian workers or people seeking asylum. The Australian workers were worried that they would be fired, that they could be prosecuted for speaking to me. The asylum seekers were worried that if they spoke to me, the government would enact some kind of retribution against them while they were trying to seek protection in Australia. And so all of the people who I talked to had to be anonymised.
You're listening to Mark Isaacs, author of Nauru Burning, An Uprising and Its Aftermath. It's not far off 6:45, ABC Radio Hobart. Mark, I mean, you signed contracts saying that you wouldn't speak about your experiences through all time. You did. Have you faced repercussions?
I haven't as of yet, or none that I'm completely aware of. I guess when I started, or when I went to publish the book, I spoke to a lawyer, or a number of lawyers, and they said, I mean, there's a possibility that you could be prosecuted for doing this. Mm. But when I was showing people the writing at the time, back in 2013, people had no idea what was going on. When I showed them what I was writing about, they were shocked. And I realised that I had this opportunity to open a window into this dark and mysterious world of the offshore processing centres. And if I didn't publish the book, people may never understand the conditions and what happens to people in these detention centres. So I was willing to take the risk and say, yeah, I'll do it. Thankfully, I haven't been prosecuted. And to be honest, I don't think many of the people will be, because I think it's a way to try and silence people. But the idea of the government actually trying to prosecute people for telling the truth about what's happening in, you know, publicly owned and run detention centres is a crime, yeah.
And as you're suggesting, you know, it's not just private companies like Wilson's who are getting a lot of money going through them and taking profits from it. It's also organisations, the welfare providers, who are getting big contracts, which are supporting those organisations as well.
Yeah.
In Nauru, with the riots, a lot of the compound was burned. How did they find out who did it? Who was punished?
Well, so on the evening of the riot, they arrested about 150 people. And they placed them in prison cells and jail cells for up to 3 weeks. They later then tried to find evidence to justify the arrest they made on the night, and many of which they couldn't do. And in the end, there was two people were found guilty of the riots, which were later overturned on appeal. And so they never actually found anyone guilty of causing the fire, of being involved in the riot, but they, for a number of months, held people in different detention centres and different camps based on their guilt, and tried to threaten people into returning home to the countries that they claimed they were fleeing persecution from, by saying, if you go home, then we won't put you in prison.
Were there still people detained on Nauru, and if so, where did they put them?
There were still people detained in Nauru, and in the first few days after it, they were just held in an area of rock with plastic bags for protection through the conditions of rain and extreme heat. And eventually, they managed to set up a temporary camp where they placed most of the men, all of the men who weren't in prison. And then since then, there have only ever been tents, and there's never been a detention centre rebuilt for the people. And keep in mind, there's most of the people I spoke to believe there was a very small amount of people involved in the actual setting fire to the camp. And the majority of the 500 people were petrified, they were worried they were going to get set on fire, they were worried that they were going to be attacked in the riots, just as much as the security guards were also frightened by what was happening in the detention centre at the time.
Well, 500 people can't set fire to something.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The camp is due to close soon, the Nauru camp. Or is that Manus Island?
Well, this is the problem with the detention centres. They talk about Manus Island having to be closed, and that was ordered by the PNG government, Papua New Guinea government, saying that it was against their constitution to have people detained without due cause. But unfortunately, the camp is still open and people still detained there. And the most recent news is that the healthcare providers on Manus Island, the International Health and Medical Services, had to abandon the island because it was found to be practicing medicine unlicensed. And that was just reported on by The Guardian. And so now the people who are detained in Manus Island do not have a healthcare provider there. What happened in Nauru was they opened the camp and said people are free to walk around the island, and so therefore they're not detained in the Nauru detention centre. But unfortunately, the island's about 10 minutes around by car, or 20 minutes around by car. It's an island of 10,000 people. So if you place 1,000 refugees on the island, that's 10% of the population. I mean, what is the sustainability of keeping people there? And considering the fire and considering the lack of communication between the two, the local Nauruan people and the asylum seekers, there's a huge amount of difficulty between that relationship.
Australia's been congratulated by a lot of people for its immigration policies and for these processes. They've been touring ministers from other countries around going, look at this, this is working. We've got control of our borders. Has anyone got an idea about how we can manage this better without using camps?
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of suggestions and possibilities for managing this better, and I think all of them should be considered when the results of detention and indefinite detention are so horrendous. You've got people dying in these detention centres, you've got people killing themselves, you've got people being killed by detention centre staff, if you think of what's happening in Manus Island. There are a huge amount of possibilities for regional resettlement solutions, for providing better ways of providing alternatives to getting on the boat. No one's saying we should encourage people to get on a boat, but at the moment, when I travel to places like Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Iran, there are no alternatives to get to Australia to actually seek protection from. Let's take the example of Afghanistan. There is no way to get to Australia from Afghanistan. If you flee to Pakistan, if you flee to Iran, we don't take resettlement from those countries. And so to then say you should come by the legal channels, those options aren't available to people. So the idea would be to increase the opportunities for people to come via legal avenues from places like Malaysia and Indonesia, rather than removing resettlement options from those locations, which is what the Liberal Coalition government has done.